Accession number 27055, Reel 2.
I'm sorry, Mr. Smith, you said there were pilots who froze.
Yes, and who didn't follow the drill of how you get out of your aeroplane. Well, as I say, I jettisoned my canopy. And then when it was getting worse, according to Alan Douglas, I decided I must get out. So I released the harness straps and carried out, I repeat, the perfect drill on how to get out. And that meant you turn your aeroplane over on its back. And then you forced your stick, your control column forward, and so that G would then take place as your engine and yourself went forward. Your body would come down. And it happened absolutely correctly and according to Batten. In no time I was out. And just in time, because when I pulled the straps on my parachute to come down, it was a matter of a few seconds before I hit the ground. It was on the side of a hill. And I bounced a few times, but you know, I was a great rugby player. There was no difference bouncing around on a rugby field. So I hit the ground and came down. And the first thing I did was to roll up my parachute and hide it in a small bush just below where I had landed. The aeroplane went on for a while before it crashed, and I knew that that was what the Germans would be looking for, because they were looking for the guns, the 20mm guns on these aeroplanes.
Were they?
That was what they were really wanted, to make sure that the Partizani
didn't get them themselves.
So then I started moving up the hill. There was a great big bush, a very thick bush, obviously a wonderful place in which to hide. So as soon as I got there, I just sat down for a few minutes to get my breath back. And then fortunately, I said to myself, oh, well, obviously I must move away from here, because this is an obvious place if the Germans would come to attack, if they were looking for me. So I then went on a few hundred yards further up, found a very small, inconspicuous bush with a little bit of grass, and I got myself in there and covered myself. And my luck was in, because there was a little shepherd boy with his sheep, and he came past. He walked over my tracks. So I thought, well, that's a wonderful thing, because if they brought dogs, that would put them off the trail. Well, it so happened that when they came back, they did. They shouted into this big bush, which I originally thought of going in, and sprayed it with machine gun fire. So fortunately, I was out, up the hill. But later that evening, the little shepherd boy came back. I realized I was going to have to make a move, and we'd been told that most of the Italians there would be on our side. They were anti-German. They were the Partizani. So when he came back, I called him. Oh, yeah. So he said to me, I'll go down. Through sign language, he would go down into the valley where his family were living. And he came back with his brother, who was a big fellow, as tall as I was. And he sort of said to me, oh, you want to eat? Sort of took a bite out of his wrist as much as to say, we better get you some food. Well, that was exactly what I wanted. So they got me down into their house, this place called Valle Scura, which is Obscure Valley, which was owned by a lawyer, a big lawyer in Genoa, Avvocato, as they call him, an advocate. And they put me in a... They were afraid of the Germans, as the old girl in the farmer said. I walked up to desk and we were afraid of the Germans. So they took me a few hundred yards up into a little sort of a cave in the hill and put me there. And I stayed there for a few days. They brought me food. It was a time when they used to have wonderful mushrooms there. They used to cut the mushrooms up and dry them and export them to the United States. There was a tremendous demand for them. And there were also chestnuts and castanea. So this old girl used to come to me for a few days when I was up there. She'd come to me in the morning with her basket. And in the basket, on the top of the basket, she would have mushrooms and chestnuts. But then she would lift up a kind of a serviette thing and put them on the side, and underneath she'd have a bit of milk and a bit of bread for me. And I lived like that for a few days. But then fortunately, it was a very wonderful family, the Peches, who lived up on the hill. Their headquarters were also down in Tulare. In fact, he was a man who made Orsolino hats, and they're the most famous hats in the world. They just export those to America. They roll them up into a little packet and they sold like hot cakes. And the second day that I was there, Mrs. Peche came over, and they had a man staying with them, a fellow called Wolf Davis, who was the captain, who had also been released when the Italians opened their jails and let everybody out. And he was staying with them. So they came down to see me, and they brought me two things which were very useful to me. First of all, they brought me an Italian-English dictionary. And the other thing they brought me, funny enough, was the complete works of Shakespeare. There was nothing I wanted more, because I was an avid supporter of Shakespeare. I knew a lot of his plays, many of them I knew off by heart. So that was a very welcome addition to what I was looking for and wanted. The old girl used to get a bit worried because I used to stoke the oven where she used to cook her bread and her pasta shooter. And she thought that I was doing this because I wanted to compensate them, but it was nothing of the sort. I just wanted exercise. There was a big tree too, a chestnut tree above where we were, and I used to do a lot of pull-ups, pulling myself up to my chin and back, and they just shook their heads and said, you know, what is this man doing? They couldn't understand that. So I was a fitness fanatic, and that was what I wanted to do. And I was only there for a few weeks when the local commander with the partisans up a little bit away from where we were, Moretti, Sassello, Biancastania, they were only an hour's walk away. And he came with his troops. He came inside and spoke to me. So he was a man who, one of his businesses in life was he used to import coal from Britain to Genoa, and then he used to dispose of it to find people who wanted coal for their various industries. And he could speak a little bit of English. So he said to me, what rank are you? Well, I wasn't fiddling around with flying officers and flight lieutenants, etc. I simply said, well, I'm a captain. He said, I'll make you a major immediately. So I got the quickest promotion I've ever had in my life. I became a major, and the reason was it helped him sell me, because I was like the prize elephant in the circus. I was a maggiore, which is a major. I was the Inglese pilota, the English pilot. And that was how he sold me to everybody there. He got tremendous support from all the Italians.
You were a prize catch.
That's right. Prize, as I say, prize elephant in the circus.
How did he use his prize catch?
Well, they just took me around and introduced me to everybody, and I got a lot of support from them. Every now and again, I would go back and see the Peches. and speak to them. It was good to see them and keep in with them because they were such wonderful people.
Did the Germans ever make an appearance from time to time or not? Did they?
Well, we had a wonderful system of the message going out. If the Germans moved out of their camp, then the message came around to all the partisans, and they communicated very quickly and very efficiently. And the Germans knew they had to be careful, because if they went too far away, then they would have got a message. I mean, there were places where the partisans used to throw a tree across the road if they were coming into a particular place where they thought they were partisans. They had to be careful, because there were some places where there were narrow gorges and ravines, and once or twice they came in, and the partisans just chopped down a tree, and they fell across the road, and then these Germans got a message, and it wasn't a very pleasant message.
But you weren't involved in any of that, or were you?
Yes, I was involved in the planning. I used to talk to them a lot, give them the benefit of my advice, which was, of course, good advice because of my experience as an officer, knowing how to plan. We had a bridge hall. I used to play bridge with a man who made a lot of money in the know with eggs. And he built this lovely home up in the mountains at Moretti. And he had with him, an Italian colonel who had deserted from the Italian army, was against the Germans, and he was living with them there in this house. And I often went there, and there were four of us, and we played bridge. And they had a contraption where they would pull down a flap to show you what the trumps were, you know, spades or clubs or diamonds or so on. And so, and then you just used to bid, 1, 2, 3, or 4. Well, I could converse enough to convey that kind of message.
I understand. Well, Mr. Smith, we've heard we've only have a few more minutes, so if you could, would like to continue your story with the partisans, we'll go as far as we can.
Well,
and your escape.
Yes, then I had a long walk back. We walked for, was it 17 days? I had a little book in my pocket with a pencil, and I used to make a note of this. And eventually we had to cross the railway line, the Colle de Tenda, which was the main railway line coming from the north, which the Germans used to get themselves down to Cairns, to the Delta. By then the Americans had come in to the south
of France.
So that was my plan, to go over and meet them. And it was quite a tough trip because we were told you must stay undercover during the daytime, because if you come out, those Germans up there will see you, and if they see you, they will take pot shots at you. So we had to stay under the trees and undercover all the time until dark, and then we started walking up. And that wasn't an easy thing to do. This young English chap who came with me, he didn't like that very much, and I had to get behind him and push him. But we also picked up three others, an Austrian and a Frenchman, and a little Polish chap, a little red-headed Polish fellow. And they asked if they could come, and I said, yeah, sure, you can come. But when we left one place where there was a doctor who helped us come over the top, he was an Alpine. And the fellow who controlled that area, which was a big area, they had cattle and milk and sheep. They fed us very well. We had a wonderful evening there. And then the next day we went over the top. And when we came to this place, I went to a little cottage on the side of the hill. And I told the person who I was. And I said to him, we're looking for a bit of help to get us over. So he said, well, here you are. They gave us a bit of food. And then he put me in the barn where he had a great big bull, a great big brown Swiss bull. Well, that didn't worry me at all because I knew all about cattle. As long as that bull had some food to eat, he was eating all the time. We were happy to stay there, and we got under the hay to keep us warm. The next morning, a man arrived, and he said he was speaking to us in Italian, trying to ensure who we were, that we weren't Germans who were trying to pull a fast one. So eventually my friend who was with me, Bill, said, why don't you show him your wings that you've got with you, you brought with you? So then he said, don't worry, speak in perfect English. He said, I am a director of a big hotel in Cairns. And he said, most of our customers are Englishmen who come from England. So that was it. The brother, who was a big strong fellow, he said, he'll take you and get you across the collade tender tomorrow. We went across the collade tender with the trains going backwards and forwards. And he said, sometimes there'll be a chap on the gate who will ask you a question. But if you don't understand him, just wave your hand and walk on. It'll be particularly all right for the Frenchman and the Austrian. But you better not speak, because they won't be able to recognize me with my English accent. So we did that. We got over. And that afternoon when we got over there, the man who had come, who was the hotelier, he was there to meet us with his daughter. It was a pretty tough climb going up the top over the hill. He showed us, the person with him was coming over to familiarize himself too, a member of the French, Mackie, who was in with the Mackie as opposed to the Partisan. And he said, you've got to go over the top and then down over the rise. And we did it. But I wanted to tell you this, it wasn't easy. Now, I made the mistake. My number two chap, he said he was getting tired, he didn't want to go. I said, keep moving. I got behind him and pushed him with my shoulder. The other chaps, they were, as we got near the top, funnily enough, the descent wasn't so steep, so it was easier to climb. I made the mistake of taking my boots off. When I tried to put them on the next morning, they were just blocks of ice. So I had to walk down without my boots, and in no time I had no socks, no anything like that. And fortunately, we met up with the Americans.
And that's how you escaped?
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Smith, we don't have time to continue, unfortunately, as you can see. We'll have to leave it here today. Can I just say thank you very, very much on behalf of the Imperial War Museum for this extraordinary contribution. There's such short notice to the Sound Archive. The museum is very grateful, and your contribution has been extremely important. Thank you very, very much indeed.
Thanks very much.
Well, thank you.